Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we feature Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence, the 2019 events held at San Francisco State University. We'll be joined by the organizer, Ken Burrows, who is longtime affiliate of San Francisco State University and the Holistic Health Center, also works with us at Project Censored. Later in the program, we'll be joined with a participant from the Gandhi King season, Neil Gorenflow of Shareable.net. will talk to us about a sharing economy in the commons and much more as it relates to our topic. And then later in the program, we will finish up with a special feature for African American History Month. We'll be joined by independent historian Michael Morey to talk about a fascinating untold history of David Fagan, the Buffalo Soldier who defected the U.S. infantry to fight with the rebels in the Philippines. In the book, Fagan, an African-American Renegade in the Philippine-American War. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we are going to begin with the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence. Those of you that have been long-time listeners of the Project Censored Show know that that likely means I'm about to announce our guest, who is Ken Burrows. And this is Ken Burrows' series that he's done at San Francisco State University for quite some time. Ken is the director of the Holistic Health Center at San Francisco State University, has an extraordinary library that he has built over the years for students. He is, of course, also a member of the Media Freedom Foundation nonprofit board that oversees Project Censored. He is a longtime contributor, of course, to Validated Independent News. Several of his students have had stories in the top 25 of the Censored Book every year. And Ken also is going to talk to us a little bit more about constructive media issues and some things that he's working on, actually has been working on for a couple of years. And again, those of you that have tuned in prior likely will recognize Ken Burrows and the constructive media literacy issue, as well as the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence. And Ken is working on a chapter for the next Censored Book, 2020, Through the Looking Glass, that Andy Roth and I are putting together. So maybe we'll even get a little bit of info and some teasers as it overlaps with our conversation today. Ken Burrows, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Nice to be here.
January 30th to April 4th. Of course, we're now February and Black History Month. Next month, March, would be Women's History Month. It's kind of interesting, as by day I wear the hat of historian, so I always wonder why we only get 1 month of those. Those should be every month, but of course the reason we have those particular dedications is because certain groups in our society have been overlooked, not just ignored, but purposely put aside or put down or subjugated. And so it's very important to tell those untold histories. And this program that Ken Burrows has put together, Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence, there's a lot of overlap there in social justice themes and just speaking truth to power, and speaking truth is power. So Ken Burrows, tell us about what you have going on this year.
This is our 14th year to host the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence. This is basically a 64-day educational and grassroots campaign devoted to the strategic and spiritual legacy of Mahatma Gandhi, and also some of his proteges, Martin Luther King being chief among them, Cesar Chavez and others. The idea is to really target a threefold path to peace, working on ourselves, working on our relationships to others, especially significant others in our lives, and finally working on our relationship to both culture and nature, if you will, our world. And so these 9 weeks between the memorial dates of Gandhi, who was killed on January 30th, and King, who was murdered on the 4th of April, these peacemakers were both murdered because of how effective they were in their work of really, of course, in Gandhi's case, freeing India from the British in large part, and King, of course, being the major moral voice of his age and helping the civil rights movement really gain momentum. So all based on nonviolence as a form of activism. But this practice period, really working to remember these core leaders to really help us not only root out existing injustice in the culture, but also become active, more peaceful, more loving, more meaningful in our own lives during these 9 weeks of practice.
So, Ken Burrows, explain to our listeners what you mean and what is meant in this context by the term nonviolence. I think people sometimes maybe scratch their head about it, or they interpret it in a particular way. Could you describe or define for us what it's meant in this context and what it has meant historically in these types of movements?
First of all, just to notice what violence is. Violence can be emotional, or verbal, or physical behavior that dominates, diminishes, or injures self or others. So nonviolence, as we are defining this via Gandhi, in terms of at least the social activist form, because personal violence would be quite different. So I'm taking it you mean that form of nonviolence is our primary focus. So looking at nonviolence, it tends to highlight injustice rather than passivity or the act of violence itself. And it stands in great contrast. It's not the mere absence of violence. A lot of people think nonviolence means just not being violent. Well, this usage allows oneself to be abused and can be called nonviolence, but it's really not what we're focused on. It's also not the avoidance of recourse to physical violence as a strategy. It's a third type of so-called nonviolence, what we call principled nonviolence. There's a desire for the positive well-being of your opponent. That on the one hand, you're basically saying to an oppressor, to someone who's acting in a socially unjust way, you're saying no to their behavior, and you're being very clear about standing up to and refusing to go along with that injustice. But the second aspect of this is you're recognizing their humanity. So you're approaching them in ways that are civil and really speaking with them in ways that they can recognize and be seen and valued. So one of the goals of nonviolent activism is to actually convert your oppressor to seeing your humanity and to recover their own humanity in the process.
So, Ken, the nonviolence principle as it associates with these movements, I know one aspect of it is also to kind of win the moral high ground so that the media and just the public in general can see the clear differentiation between the oppressor and the oppressed. Can you speak a little bit to that dynamic?
You bet. Gandhi's work in particular, and King had his own version of this. Gandhi basically, there are Indian terms, Sanskrit terms that I refer to. One is ahimsa, which is Sanskrit word meaning desire not to harm anyone or to not to harm the other. And then the prefix meaning just the opposite. So ahimsa or nonviolence is this desire not to harm another being. And also Gandhi had this vow to truth, a promise to really seek the truth, to live by truth and confront untruth, whatever he found it. Also a vow to love, which is essentially nonviolence. Also a vow to absorb suffering and the practice of approaching your opponent, actually speaking to them and meeting them and highlighting the injustice that is part of their behavior. You often get acted out upon. You become, their retribution becomes part of what you actually receive and expect. And then finally, a vow to control your own passions, to really be whole enough in your process to be recognized as very human and calling out the greater good in all of us in some direct way, including the very vow to limit your own possessions.
We're speaking with Ken Burrows. He is a lecturer at San Francisco State University. He's been there a very long time, couple of decades, Ken. You've taught thousands of students in the holistic health field and holistic health area, and you direct this program there. You are also, of course, the force behind the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence we're discussing right now. But Ken Burrows, you do so many other things, and I mentioned in the brief introduction your role in Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored. But you do other things on campus and off that actually overlap greatly with the principles of nonviolence that you're talking about. And the one that I wanted to revisit, you mentioned ahimsa, and I wanted to go back to satyagraha. We live in an interesting time, to say the least. In the last 2 years, we've been confronted with new terms as concepts, right? That we need alternative facts to buttress fake news in a so-called post-truth world. And satyagraha, that's not new at all, right? That's about confronting untruths, but it's also about ferreting them out and seeking the truth. Talk a little bit about that and how that comes through your program and the things that you do.
I teach holistic health and public health for a living, the mix of these two. So this idea of satyagraha, or this force of truth or soul force, the higher aspects of our nature, beauty, truth, and goodness, are really what we're often leaving out of the equation. There's a biological term called the negativity bias. And the negativity bias is all about recognizing the value of that we pay attention to threats, that threats, in fact, can really harm us. So we have to pay attention to them. So we're constantly very vigilant about what might harm us. And therefore, you see in our press, our whole press is a litany of really human failures, fraud, war, crime. You know, that's our media structures. We're covering what actually threatens us. And this approach is very different. It's to recognize the higher aspects of human nature and that we're really committed to truth, most of us. We want to know what's going on. In fact, we're looking at a possible threat as a possible truth. So fake news, of course, is distorting that whole process. So Gandhi was saying very clearly that we have to live in pursuit of truth. We have to live with integrity and a willingness to confront untruth. And that process is, of course, what good media is about, good media literacy is about. It's about this very fact of being clear-eyed and open-hearted in our look at the news and with each other.
Given that we're talking about the Gandhi King season for nonviolence, part also, I think, of looking at Satyagraha, the whole principle of nonviolence, is really looking at the movements and the social and political transformation that's often attached to it generationally. How does that come out? I mean, you have a lot of fantastic speakers you bring in, right? You're definitely one of the people that knocks down the four walls of the classroom and opens it up, which is how it ought to be, in my opinion, as a fellow educator. But talk to us a little bit about some of the speakers, some of the themes, the bigger, broader concepts, and where do you see those going?
The whole idea of the season for nonviolence was created because after the passing of these activist luminaries that were very much a moral voice for both of their times and places, the families and a lot of interfaith ministers and politicians, and really, I should say more of the activist community than politicians, wanted to really use their lives and their message to continue to think outside the box of how do we do activism in a way that's truly sustainable and truly works. Fact is that most people do not understand principle nonviolence and how powerful it is. If we wake up to that principle as an activist principle, it can change almost everything. So there's the fact of having the whole idea of social evils in our midst as part of society. Gandhi named seven of them: wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, and politics without principles. And if you look around, those are very, very different than what we're living in day to day.
We can certainly see how our society is plagued by these seven social evils, for sure. And you're talking about then how principles of nonviolence help not just work against that, but transcend that to have a different reality. So how do you see some of the folks that are coming in to share? I mean, again, I'm looking at the schedule here. On Mondays, for those of you that are local to the San Francisco Bay Area, Mondays, 5 o'clock, it's the HSS 306 building on the San Francisco State campus. And you have some pretty amazing people coming in, some pretty amazing themes coming in, including the Heroes Imagination Project. Looks very fascinating. And, of course, you also have the people from Shareable. And later on in the program, we'll be joined by your friend and colleague, Neil Gorenflot.
That's great.
From Shareable. Right. So maybe tell our listeners a little bit about a couple of these people or a couple of these examples of how you're doing principled nonviolence in the series.
We have two main windows of time. If anyone would like to join us, all of our programs are free. Mondays in the HSS building, room 306, and then certain selected Wednesdays also, same building, HSS and room 135. That would be on Wednesday night for those programs. But some of the interesting speakers we have coming, and also we're hosting a couple of teach-in events. We just had a wonderful presenter. He'll be returning. He'll be talking about mindfulness. The whole mindfulness movement is taking off. A lot of people really don't understand it, but it's about really being present to your conditions, your realities, and with that presence, really staying present and open and non-judgmentally so. You have a chance to engage with it directly without bias. And surprisingly so, that changes almost everything. It changes your perspective. It changes your relationship to others when you actually meet them where they are and not as you might judge them to be. And the whole game shifts. So my friend Forrest Fine, who is the director of mindfulness programs at the UCSF Osher Integrated Medicine Center, also has partnerships in the community. He's working with homeless youth and those underserved and really helping them in their own personal practices of dealing with the very challenging conditions they live in, not having home or income and often a place to sleep at night. So he would be one. I can mention a couple of others. Thomas Puble is coming to speak about a collective trauma that we all carry from past genetic experience that's there in all of us because of this. We're all survivors of this predator-prey lineage of our animalistic tendencies and looking at collective trauma and how to develop an inner science that help us know, notice and be active in the choices we're making and be able to shift our own choices more effectively as we deal with these day-to-day traumas that are reflecting our past. We'll be looking at prison reform. We'll be looking at the process of the Enneagram, which is about understanding 9 different coping and problem-solving styles that people use to be more effective in their teamwork and their organizations. And we'll be finishing up with a teach-in that Neil will be talking about in part. We'll be finishing the 9 weeks out with looking at basically the loneliness in our culture, the social decline and community decline, and what do we do about all of this.
So, Ken, I'm fascinated with the nonviolence principles and how it relates to these political movements. So I really want to ask you about 2 things that I've noticed. The first is that when you see a political movement that hasn't expressly tied itself to these nonviolent principles, you risk that some one actor in the group might misbehave or act out violently, and then the public can then deem the entire group or label the entire group as that one individual's actions. And we see this a lot. One person shatters a Starbucks window where a giant protest was otherwise very peaceful, and then that is how the group gets labeled and then demonized. And then the other aspect of this is that when a group that is not used to being violent tries to meet the violence that with more violence, you're playing the game of the oppressor, and they're always going to be willing to take that further than you are. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can just kind of speak to those 2 issues of these political movements tying themselves to the nonviolence principle.
You bet. There's a pretty famous black bloc group that often shows up in demonstrations that believe in violence as a tool, and often they show up in whereas the largest part of the crowd will be nonviolent in their demonstrations. They will be the ones often breaking the windows of shops and so on. And also, it's agent provocateurs often even coming from various groups, including police, have been discovered numerous times embedded in plain clothes.
Long history of COINTELPRO.
Long history.
Very long. This is a very long-standing tactic that's still sadly with us.
And therefore, the crowd looks violent, and therefore the crowd is seen by others as less effective and less to be respected in their message.
Well, I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking right now with Ken Burrows about the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence. This is the 14th annual program that Ken Burrows has put together at San Francisco State University. And after this break, we'll be back and continue our conversation with Ken Burrows. Stay with us.
It seems to me that there are 3 ways that oppressed people can deal with their oppression.
What are they, Dr. King?
Well, one is to rise up in open violence, in physical violence. And some persons have used that method, persons who have been oppressed. But I think the danger of that method is its futility. I feel that violence creates many more social problems than it solves. I admire freedom fighters wherever they are, but I still believe that nonviolence is the strongest approach. So I don't think it's limited to a particular locality. I think it should apply in every situation in the world where individuals seek to break loose from the bondage of colonialism or from some totalitarian regime or from the system which we confront in America.
You truly believe, then, that nonviolence is the sole, the universal answer to injustice and oppression?
Very definitely. Very definitely. I feel that nonviolence, organized nonviolent resistance, is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
You make a difference, a distinction between passive resistance and non-violent resistance, is that it?
Well, I think that can be something of a semantical problem. If passive resistance means just passively accepting violence or injustice, if it means cowardice and stagnant passivity, then there is a difference, because nonviolent resistance does resist. It is dynamically active. It is passive physically, but it is strongly active spiritually.
In a sense, would you regard it as moving into the Christian philosophy too? You mean the doctrine of turn the other cheek to regard as positive rather than passive?
I think it is positive. I think very definitely, if it is used properly and accepted with a proper attitude, it is a very strong method. It is a method of the strong man, not the weak man.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Ken Burrows is the director of the Holistic Health Program and Center at San Francisco State University, longtime board member of Media Freedom Foundation, and contributor to Project Censored. Today, we're talking to Ken about Gandhi King's Season for Nonviolence. It's the 14th year that he's put together this 64-day program. It's 64 days to practice weaving love and wise action into daily life. Before the break, Chase was asking Ken about how movements get targeted. Even though many social justice movements, anti-war movements are nonviolent, it only takes a handful of actors to poison the well, so to speak, because our corporate media loves a spectacle. And they gravitate, as Ken Burrows, you said earlier, you were talking about the negativity bias. And so it doesn't seem to be a sexy enough story to tell about how thousands of people are, in principled fashion, passive resistance, right? But not passive in a sit down, like don't do anything way, mm-hmm. but more of a we're not moving to get out of your way, right? We're protesting this overall institutional violence that might be happening. So how do we get around the negativity bias, and how do we even escape the binary problem solution issue in journalism? Because once people get out of school or what have you, they have their smartphones, but dumb media. They have social media. They have things algorithmically coming into their feed. They watch a lot of corporate news media. And there's really a lot of that bull, that negativity bias there. And you have been long talking about even escaping solutions journalism, which of course is necessary within that binary structure. But you're talking about something that's more transcendent than all of that, that you call constructive media or constructive media mm-hmm. literacy. Talk to us a little bit more about how that factors mm-hmm. into the messages of the Season for Nonviolence.
Media is, of course, why we're here in part, and we're using the very form of media as we speak. First of all, critical media literacy, the way it's often framed, I see media literacy as often too critical. There's a word I find quite interesting that's very useful psychologically for doing the work. The word is overcare. Every strength we use can be overused, and it becomes a weakness. So we can be too critical, and we become caught in judgment and bias all the time. And we have a three-legged model we use. You use the metaphor of a stool or a camera. The lens of the camera needs to be clear and precise. And we think it is clear and precise when it has these three legs to it. Yes, critical media. We need to have very good critical thinking skills. We need to look at what might be wrong. We need to be clear about that problem-focused view. We need to be aware of the problems and willing to face them. That's very clear. Yet, instead of just that, we need to open up a larger media model, which we're calling the mindful media movement, to really change the way media is, to include the two other legs on this stool or camera tripod. And those two other legs, one of them is solution-based. Yes, we have problem-focused media. We should look at solution-focused media, what we call innovation or design-oriented media. How do we design our future so that it's very different than the one we're in? It means, of course, seeing the problems and looking at how to find solutions and design thinking for those problems. Yet it's the third leg that intrigues me the most. And this leg has to do with what you might call growing the good, recognizing the connections we have, the common good and the greater good amongst us. When we're together and things are working well, that synergy that comes in a culture that allows us to divide our workforce and align our work accordingly to our different skills and talents. On a good day, we're running around, we're really truly a society of connections and possibilities. And that feeds everything that we can buy, eat, choose, and do. So that common and greater good is fed by this third form of media that has to do with the arts, which help awaken imagination, awaken positive sense of awakening a strength-based approach to thought and existence through positive narratives, visions, a sense of our mutual connections around the common good that we're all a part of something, and the truth and the beauty and this greater good that we really swim in by the day, but we don't pay attention to when we have this natural biological bias to be threat aware and vigilant. We could talk about the chemistry of the body and the brain physiology as well to understand this choice. But when we're reactive, we can't be creative. And we need a form of media that feeds our sense of connection with each other, this common good and the greater good of the higher aspects of our nature. So deepening our connections, deepening our sense of our the possibilities that come when we do connect. And the arts remind us of that. Humor, play. You turn around and you hear a piece of music and you're connected with the person standing next to you if it's good art. So finding the rituals and the art and everything else that helps us find that third leg of this mindful media movement will give us a future with vision, not just a future of reactivity. And that's what we're hoping to talk more about.
It's funny you say that, Ken. While you were saying that, I was thinking about one of the big themes in our media today is CNN versus Fox News. Because of this negativity bias and this kind of appeal to conflict, we're attracted to conflict. We see mostly our media, left versus right, arguing about the few areas where we disagree. And you don't see a media institution that is purely presenting news and information around the areas where we actually all agree and are ready to put policy in place. I just wonder if that media institution would get any traffic or why it doesn't exist. Why isn't there a media organization committed to just talking about the policies that the left and right already agree on?
That's a great question. I think one of the main reasons is that centralized power structures on the left and right, of course, sponsoring media that feed their narrative. Most of us are looking for what isn't working, right? So mm-hmm. The left is identifying the hidden history of the billionaires driving what's going on the right, right? And the darkness of centralized power there. And the centralized power on the left is neoliberal in its orientation, and it's hidden in the system. It's structural. And so those on the right can point at it much more effectively. So we're really not seeing our own darkness, each side. And the bankruptcy of the left is increasingly evident, the neoliberal left. So to think of a station or a video form or some form of media that would really hold the creative tension of a larger truth, it'd have to be funded in some way. It'd have to have mm-hmm. structural existence. But we don't live in that system right now. We have a profit-driven system.
Right.
So it has to come through community-oriented radio. It has to show up in the public. It has to show up in the rest of us somehow coming together and making media like we are right now. So I don't see some big CNN Fox hybrid that's going to somehow emerge and really give us what we want in some kind of institutionalized structure way just yet. But Gandhi had a very interesting idea of his activism. He said there are two kinds of activism. There's constructive activism and there's obstructive activism. And so he had what he called constructive programs. So one of those constructive programs could be to create a media outlet and really begin to have a vision that would be truly inclusive and including recognizing the shadows on both sides of the political aisle. We'd have to gather enough of the population to have an interest to watch it. And we'd have to really have that shared moral story that can guide us in that appropriate vision and that appropriate look.
And one of the other problems is people tend to not want to spend time focusing on things they already know or already believe in, right? Okay. I think our mind naturally wants to challenge things and see what's next and what are the issues that are still up for grabs. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Many people think that constructive media would be bland, would be boring, mm-hmm. right? It's like, why would I go watch that movie? Well, there really are movies that speak to our higher nature and that actually touch us and are really strength-based, but more character-based. And we often, many of us look for the kind of movies that we, it's not just about feeling better, it's about getting better and really knowing that there is improvement. This kind of media, I think, really can help us find our way past this hope gap and this domination of cynicism that really drives most of our choices.
Isn't this kind of middle ground, wasn't that in some ways the promise of social media, that everybody would be sharing this playing field and it would no longer be the left media yelling at the right or the right yelling at the left, that we would all kind of hop into this place and be able to find these common themes that we agree on? Yet somehow we've gotten very far away from that.
Well, if you've got special interests, being able to pay for bots planting algorithms in our systems and affecting the very media we can read. And it's the centralized power problem once again. So the open source of the original planners and the founder of the Internet and those that started all this are saying we need to reinvent what's happened because it's been corrupted.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Helf with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with Ken Burrows. And this first segment today, we've been talking about the Gandhi King season for nonviolence. It's 64 days to practice weaving love and wise action into daily life. Ken Burrows puts together this program, has done it every year for the last 14 years. It's going on right now at San Francisco State University. You can learn more at sfsu.edu/tilde/season-of-nonviolence.html. But I do think, Ken, you can find it from the sfsu.edu site as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can even just use a regular search engine and you can look the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence, San Francisco State, something of that nature.
And that particular link is housed on the Holistic Health Learning Center site. And if you do that, that's very easy to Google and find.
Good, good. So, you know, we just were wrapping this segment and you both were talking about the idea of sharing and what we share. I mean, Ken, you were also talking about problems of centralized power. And even though social media had this pretense of diffusing that and spreading it out, what we've seen is it's just actually more like data theft. It's been a way to take things from people that they were willing to share, right? So it's not theft. It's not considered that. But this whole platform that you mentioned, right, is something that could be transformed, could be used differently. And I know Chase Palmieri can talk a lot about that, and we'll be talking about that on future programs, about different ways to be using online sources for news and trustworthy sources and building community. The next guest that we want to bring on is a colleague of yours, Ken Burrows, and that would be Neil Gorenflot from Shareable.net. He was one of the co-founders there. So after this break, we'll have Neil Gorenflot join the program. So stay with us.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. That is something about this method that has power. And I know that there are those who will ridicule it occasionally, but it has worked miracles in the South. It has morality with it because it gives us the opportunity to work to secure moral ends through moral means. This is the morality of it, but it has certain practical consequences. It exposes the moral defenses of the opponent, somehow weakens his morale, and all at the same time it is working on his conscience. It disarms him and he just doesn't know what to do with it. If he puts you in jail, that's all right. If he doesn't put you in jail, fine. If he beats you up, that's all right. If he doesn't beat you up, that's all right. If he tries to kill you, all right. You develop the quiet courage of dying if necessary without killing. If he tries to threaten you, all right. If he doesn't. And that is something about it which causes the opponent not to know what to do. Now, he would know what to do with violence. He could call out the state militia. He could call out the National Guard and kill hundreds and hundreds of innocent people and argue that they are inciting a riot. They know how to handle violence, but they proved over and over again that they don't know how to handle nonviolence because they throw people... They try to handle it by throwing us in jail. But what happens? We go into the jails of Jackson, Mississippi, and transform these jails from dungeons of shame to havens of freedom and human dignity. I can't stop it. I believe firmly that this is the way.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. In the first segment, we were talking with Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University about the Gandhi King Season of Nonviolence that's actually happening right now at San Francisco State University. And we mentioned before the break that we were going to bring on another guest, a colleague, someone that has worked with Ken off and on various projects and various capacities over the years, and in fact has been on the Project Censored Show before, but it's been a long time. And we are honored to bring back on the program Neil Gorenflot of Shareable.net. That's S-H-A-R-E-A-B-L-E, shareable.net. Neil Garenflow is the co-founder of Shareable, an award-winning news action connection hub for the sharing transformation. Neil's going to talk more about that. An epiphany in 2004 inspired Neil to leave the corporate world to help people share through startups, publishing, grassroots organizing, and a circle of friends committed to the common good. And of course, in the previous segment, those concepts all came up with Ken Burrows in our conversation with he and Chase. And Neil Garenflow, people can learn more about you at shareable.net. You've been all over. So leaving the corporate world was a great thing for you to really, really grow your vision. And of course, you've gone back and even helped many people in the corporate as well as nonprofit world with what you do at Shareable. So welcome back to the Project Censored Show, Neil.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
So tell our listeners, just remind them, what is Shareable.net?
We're an NGO founded in 2009, and our mission is to empower people to share. And the way we do that is through our solutions journalism and also our campaigns and community organizing. And on our publishing side, our editorial strategy is to inspire and empower. So we write about ways that people are sharing in their communities that are unexpected and that go against the grain of what people commonly think will work and are surprising in some way. And that inspires people. People read those stories and like, I want to do that in our community. And they'll start something. And the empower part is we have how-to articles and guides and books that take people step by step on how to start a tool library or a worker cooperative or a time bank, et cetera. And what we're really trying to do is spark replication of these community strategies to share wealth, share power, share resources.
So, Neil, again, shareable.net. This is your 10th anniversary this year?
In September, it'll be 10 years.
You've been doing an awful lot of influencing. You've been doing a lot of sharing. The website is just chock full of the information. Earlier in the program, we were talking with Ken Burrows about the Gandhi King Season of Nonviolence, and Ken mentioned that you're slated to actually close that this year. And so I was just curious as to how you're going to relate the work that you do at Shareable to what's going on at SF State with Ken this year.
We're going to do a participatory magazine. This is part of our new strategy to do quarterly in-depth deep dives, teach-ins that have a live stream and articles and an event to really bring our community together to look at an issue and catalyze action, right? And so we're partnering with Ken and San Francisco State University during this Gandhi King Season of Nonviolence and close it out with an event that will really focus on social isolation as an issue. You know, it turns out that this is a growing problem in quote-unquote developed nations around the world. Since 1985 in the United States, we've gone from a country where the average person had three close friends that they could really confide in, you know, tell their troubles to and get support, to just one. And many people, that's the average, and many people have zero people they can go to with their troubles and get support with. And this is deeply troubling on many levels. First, the personal suffering that people experience when they're alone and when they're isolated, and the impact that has on their well-being and their prospects in society. And also, it's in the way we're looking at it too, is we're kind of reframing it from a public health issue, which is a lot of the way that people look at it, and looking at it as a crisis of society, right? It's not just that it's a collection of people who are lonely and suffer health effects, it's that it's also a sick society. If we're not connected, if we can't talk to each other, if we can't understand each other, if we can't work together, then, you know, we can't face any of the major problems that we have, like climate change and inequality and racism and all that stuff. And we're also vulnerable to negative populism, venting our anger at others for our problems. So social isolation, I think, can contribute to violence and bringing people together, both with bridging and bonding capital, not just getting people together in tribes, but also connecting with people that are different from them. This is a way towards nonviolence also, or at least can I think, powerfully contribute to nonviolence.
So you're talking literally about a rebirth of our democratic society, it sounds like, in some way. And this event is going to be part of a series of events that they were hoping to host.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, in the charitable pantheon of intellectuals, one of our gods, or goddesses rather, is Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics, as a political scientist, actually, for her work on the governance of commons and her study of, like, a multi-decade study of commons around the world. She used the term common pool resources. These are assets that are managed by the community of users, and they usually have three important components. First, there's an asset to be shared. It could be a forest, a fishery, a business, a piece of software. Then there's a community of users and managers of the asset and contributors. And then there's a governance process. And this is the key piece. This is what keeps it working and makes it a commons, is that there's governance. It's an asset that is governed by the users. And with a long-term perspective, not for profit, for community benefit. And Eleanor Ostrom, one of her kind of philosophies that really attracted me to her, and I think which speaks to what we need now in our society, and also speaks to this issue of social isolation and the Gandhi King season of nonviolence, is that democracy isn't just going to the voting booth. It's any time people get together to make decisions about how to manage their lives and manage what they need to live well. It's democracy with a small d. And if we want a powerful democracy, we have both reinvigorate and reform our democracy with a big D institutions, and also those that make up the small d. And by pursuing, you know, democracy with a small d, we can reconnect people in very constructive, peaceful ways, where they can help meet their needs, you know, where people can help meet their needs together, where there's mutual aid, support, solidarity. That's what we're really going to focus on in the event with Ken in mid-April. Go to shareable.net, sign up for our email newsletter. It's a weekly newsletter, and we'll be sending out the dates and the program within the next couple of weeks. And all the news and stories that we're doing leading up to the event will be published and circulated through the newsletter. So we're going to really, like, school people up. And then the event will be like the climax, where we're all together. We've leveled up our knowledge through our editorial. And then we can have a really informed discussion. That is one of four big events we're doing this year, doing quarterly participatory magazine. And we're going to do issues. The other issues are, we're going to do one on disaster collectivism, on community waste mitigation, and then one on zoning and housing. So that's what we've got planned for the year. And the invitation to your listeners is to come join us in these discussions, help shape them. They're more like a teach-in, more like we're doing this together. Let's learn together and then figure out what can be done together.
So, Neil, on a very practical level, how would a user interact with your site? Let's say I'm a brand new user and I go to shareable.net. What am I going to see, and what am I going to be doing on the platform?
It's kind of like an online magazine with case studies about how people are sharing in cities around the world. So you can think of it also as a database of solutions. We have something like 5,000 stories in our archive of all different types of solutions that people can implement in their communities. So you can search and see, search by where you live and see if there's anything you want to connect with that's in your community. Or if there's, you want to do something in your community, you can see how other people have done it, like do a search on time banks, and you can see how people have done time banks, get a how-to on time banks, or co-working or co-living or tiny houses, little free libraries. There's literally hundreds of different community solutions for sharing resources that you can check out. One suggestion too is, at the top of our site is a banner where you can get our free book called Sharing Cities, Activating the Urban Commons. So just click on that, download the PDF, and this will give you an idea of what does a whole city look like if it's run by people on a basis of sharing and the urban commons.
So, Neil, we just have a few minutes to finish up. Any final comments or thoughts that you have about creating a future of sharing and democratic connection?
The first thing to recognize is, while the mainstream media and the news that you see, oh, it's very troubling. There is no question about it. I think this is one of the reasons why we're going from a kind of more online format to, like, let's get together face to face and talk about solutions and work towards and catalyze solutions and work on solutions. We need to get together face to face, not online, not Twitter and Facebook. Let's meet each other and gain a better understanding of what our needs are, where we are as people, and work together, find the common ground, and work on common solutions. While there is that troubling news out there, the good news that what we see on Shareable is a rising tide of people coming together to solve their own issues in their own community in their own way, not waiting for the next politician or someone to come save them. Screw it, let's do it ourselves. Let's work with what we have right now, with the people that we have, with the assets that we have on hand, and make it happen. That's a global movement. And that's really what we're charting and what people, we're encouraging people to connect to, that spirit and that movement.
Neil Gorenflot, co-founder, Shareable.net, Shareable. There are a lot of things, Neil, that you reminded listeners about and polled listeners they can find on your site. And of course, in April, early April, wrapping up Ken Burroughs' Gandhi and King season for nonviolence. Neil Gorenflot, thanks so much for coming back on the Project Censored Show and for all the work you do at Shareable. Thanks for sharing with us today on the Project Censored Show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we're going to do a segment for African American History Month. We're going to have a segment that looks at a brand new book out from University of Wisconsin Press by Michael Morey. It's about the history of David Fagan, an African American renegade in the Philippine American War. Stay with us.
Now you masters of war, you that build all of the guns, you that build the dead planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, just want you to know that I see through your mask.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In the final segment today, independent historian Michael Morey has a new book out on the University of Wisconsin Press, Fagan. It's about David Fagan, and Michael Morey is going to talk to us all about that. The book is called Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War. And Michael Morey, I'm also involved in historian. I'm chair of the history department, co-chair at Diablo Valley College. I teach the Spanish-American War in the Philippines every semester, and Michael Levitin, who's done work on our show, connected us with you, and we wanted to have you on for this brief segment. So, Michael Morey, you're an independent historian. Tell us what that means for our listeners.
That means I don't have advanced academic degrees. There are a lot of people like this, journalists and others, who decide they want to write a book of history, but I consider myself something of a party crasher in terms of being an historian. I don't even call myself an historian, but I certainly worked very hard on this book, and my research is very solid, and Wisconsin was happy with the writing.
Well, Michael Morey, tell us about it. You wrote the story of David Fagan, a 20-year-old Buffalo soldier sent as a private in the U.S. 24th Infantry to help quell the Filipino resistance, and of course, this involves Emilio Aguinaldo and many other characters. Tell our listeners a little bit, what is this story of David Fagan, and how did you get so interested in it?
Well, I'm interested in being an American, what it means to be an American, and how we have conflicts of loyalty. My own experience during the Vietnam era, being a very patriotic American, but against the war, I felt quite conflicted. And nobody could have been more conflicted than the Buffalo soldiers in the Philippines sent to suppress the Philippines' quest for independence. David Fagan, like about 15 others of the soldiers who were sent there, identified with the revolutionaries, and he had a terrible time with his southern white officer over him, and so he finally deserted. And for a year and a half, he led assaults and ambushes for the Filipino guerrillas, large and small. They never could catch him. General Frederick Funston was obsessed with trying to kill David Fagan, but couldn't do it. Fagan became a household word in America as news about his exploits reached the country. In the Philippines, they were fascinated with him. He was a legendary figure. But they never could find out too much about him, and I wanted to really track down his military record and try to find out who this guy was, what he was like. And finally, there was a real controversy about his death. He was supposedly killed by a Filipino hunting party after the war was over with a reward on his head. But many people have speculated that he had faked his death and lived on, but nobody's ever presented any evidence. And I dug into it in the Philippines and in the National Archives and elsewhere. And I think I've really substantiated that he lived on at least for five more years after faking his death as the most notorious bandit leader in northern Luzon.
So, Michael Mori, given what we know about the Spanish-American War, the Philippines' end of it was remarkably brutal. Not that what happened in Cuba and Puerto Rico wasn't. But in the U.S., there's definitely focus on the Caribbean, what happened in Cuba, of course, how that eventually spawned the Castro Revolution against Batista. Of course, we still see issues with what's happening with U.S. Dominion in Puerto Rico. This is really the beginnings, really. We're eliminating, of course, the Native American genocide here. The colonists, the early United States, was ever westward moving and imperial. But the Spanish-American War was the first major foray out into the oceans, and the Philippines was the most far-reaching. And, of course, there were other reasons to hem in the Japanese, control trade with China. Can you situate this a little bit historically as what you know as to what influenced Fagan?
What influenced Fagan was, of course, the Jim Crow in America was just taking effect, this degrading separate but equal system. Lynching was at its peak. Blacks were being disenfranchised. Their situation had not been good, to say the least, but it became really drastic as they became the American scapegoat. Obviously, the blacks were very conflicted who were serving. Many of them felt that they, by being loyal, they would lessen the hostility towards them, and others had it, like Fagan and about 15 others, and they went over to the other side.
And so, in your mind, Fagan defected because of not the element of imperialism, but just the acts of oppression and racism that he was seeing in his own life, in his own homeland, for an army he was fighting for. And this is only a couple years after the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling in 1896 that legalized segregation and Jim Crow.
Correct. It's hard to say because Fagan left nothing in writing. He was a man of action, and I was cautioned, and I felt that I couldn't put too much into his mind. I can't pretend to know exactly what he was thinking, but I certainly did everything I could. The book involved a lot of what we call informed speculation. I went along and invited the reader to come along with me as we put out the evidence that we have there, and everybody's allowed there to try to get their own take on this guy. But he was a marvelous character, and he was a flamboyant character. He was often amusing. He liked carousals. He liked to party. He had a Filipino wife. He played guitar. But he was ferocious in battle, and he was a brilliant strategist as a guerrilla leader, and frustrated the Americans immensely because they just simply could not catch and kill this guy, though they tried desperately.
So you'd maybe describe Fagan as someone that was beating the American military at their own game, which sounds fairly frustrating.
Yeah, General Frederick Funston, a little sawed-off general, the most famous military guy of that Philippine War, was obsessed with killing Fagan, with hanging him from a picket rope as soon as he could get a hold of him. He just simply couldn't do it, and he was very, very frustrated, and so were the American authorities.
Michael Mori, you did a lot of research for this. What kind of research did you do in terms of files or information?
Four trips to the National Archives digging in the files. There's just mountains of files there. They're old, dusty, yellowing documents that are buried in all kinds of odd places. And also in the Philippines. I went to the Philippines with Michael Anthony, thank goodness. I couldn't have done it without him. And went to Fagan country and sort of traced his steps around and got a sense of the Filipino people of that region who were just wonderful to us.
Michael Mori, we're going to need to wrap up the segment in a minute. Real quickly, what is the big takeaway here? What do you hope that people take away from your fascination with Fagan's life and his acts against the American empire?
Well, I hope they'll learn more about the Philippine-American War, which has been long buried quite intentionally, and about what was happening with African-Americans at that turn of the century. And about David Fagan himself, I wanted to do right by him. The military went out of its way to expunge him from the record. They couldn't do that. They wanted to make him out as a criminal or just a bad man. And I wanted to do justice by David Fagan.
Anywhere we can find out more online, Michael Morey, about your book, Fagan?
Sure. Just Google either my name or the name Fagan, an African-American renegade. You can see my Facebook page, or you can read about the book on Wisconsin's page.
So it's Michael Morey, M-O-R-E-Y, David Fagan, F-A-G-E-N. Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War, is the title. It is out soon by University of Wisconsin Press. Michael Morey, good luck on your book talks. It sounds like a really important book and a really important part of our untold history. Thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show for African-American History Month.
You are welcome, and thank you very much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program, with myself, co-host Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback about our work, and last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured, paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the ties with a master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got